Respected guests, friends, young people, and brothers and sisters. Our lecture this evening is called a Signs of the Times lecture. And this is the fifth time this year here in Central Texas that we have given a lecture on the signs of the times. And so in preparing this, I was trying to figure out a way to not be too repetitive and to find some way to differentiate this lecture from the last four that I've given. And what I was feeling was the same thing Brother Lynn Osborne referenced earlier this week before giving us yet another first principle lecture on the devil and who he is. Sometimes we feel tempted to try and find a different way, a way to speculate on things which may be interesting but which may or may not be correct. And as Brother John Wolfe showed us Thursday evening, the things we've been studying this week are the same things that the brethren were studying on these grounds in 1896. So maybe this constant repetition is old-fashioned. Maybe we need some new approach. Now, there are many events going on in this political world that we could speculate on, and these things may be interesting, but all these things are still in the process of unfolding, and we're not quite sure exactly what God's plan will be in the end with them. And it is such that really doesn't make that material for a Bible lecture, even though it might be interesting. And many have remarked from our studies this week in Romans how the Apostle Paul always backed up his arguments with an appeal to the Old Testament. The only Bible he had was the Old Testament, and he always substantiated everything by it. And that's what a Bible lecture is, and that's what it should be. It should back up all its statements constantly with references to the Bible. Now, as I considered these things over the past month, I received an email from a friend who is not currently associated with Christadelphians asking me to read and give him my opinion on an article which had just appeared in the June Christadelphian magazine, a magazine for the central body of Christadelphians and which they had posted on their website. The article was not written by an individual, but rather it was signed by the entire committee for that magazine. As I read the first paragraph and thinking about my lecture this evening, it said, "It is apparent to all of us that the gospel truth is under serious threat in these last days, just as we expected it to be." Well, I thought, here is an angle for the signs of the times that I haven't spoken on. There truly is to be a falling away prior to the last days. The Apostle Paul warned us in 2 Peter 3 at verse 3, "Knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers, walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation." And we should all here this evening be quite attentive that this doesn't happen to us. The Central Committee went on in reference that also from among yourselves men will rise up, speaking perverse things to draw away disciples after themselves. That too is very true, and something we need to be very aware of. The full quote is quite powerful. It's in Acts 20, verse 28. There the Apostle Paul said, "Take heed therefore unto yourselves and to all the flock over the which the Holy Spirit hath made you overseers, to feed the ecclesia of God which he hath purchased with his own blood. For I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you, not sparing the flock. Also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away disciples after them. Therefore watch and remember that by the space of 3 years I cease not to warn everyone night and day with tears." The dangers of falling away is so powerful that Paul felt it was necessary to warn the true believers in tears. And as I thought about how I might develop this thought, I thought back to the days when the late Brother H.P. Mansfield, the leading central brother of the time, came to High in the late 1950s. In those days, the brethren were meeting under this tabernacle exactly as we are doing this week, and as exactly as Brother John Wolfe showed us that they were doing in the 1890s. They were assembling every day for exhortations and first principle lectures. And being he was with the Central folks and we Bereans had separated from him, he was not invited to speak or address the assemblies. And after spending a few days here, Brother Mansfield's conclusion was that our work here was shallow, was the word he used. And of course, he was correct if we understand that word to mean basic, which I think is what he really meant. We focus on the basics, the foundations of our faith. And we exhort and lecture each other over and over again on these basic first principles of truth. This was, in fact, the very problem I was experiencing in preparing this lecture. How do I say the same basic things in a different way? So anyway, I read on in the article, and as I read on, I discovered that the article was actually a list of complaints which the committee was making, which they alleged was now affecting the Central Christadelphians. They had listed a number of complaints there, all of them quite remarkable, and I'm not going to go over any of them except the first one. Their complaint was, a robust and comprehensive understanding of what Christadelphians believe and practice, including aspects of separation from the world, is not deemed essential to true baptism. Well, baptizing or accepting the baptism of folks who do not know the truth is the very cause of the first Christadelphian division ever when John Thomas separated from Benjamin Wilson in 1851. Wilson went on to form just another Christian church called the Church of God of the Abrahamic Covenant. John Thomas went on to unify those who believed the truth and were baptized after coming to a knowledge of the truth as Christadelphians. There would be no such thing as Christadelphians today apart from the maintenance of this belief. Now, we have no way of knowing the validity of the central editor's charges. Certainly, the editors of the Christadelphian magazine should know the condition of their own body. But if true, it shows that portions of the Christadelphian movement is now becoming very weak and now ready to be reassimilated into the churches from which we once came out. And we must be very much on our guard that the falling away as Christ returns and comes near does not happen to us. It's not enough to recognize that Christ's return is near. We must arm ourselves to remain firm in the faith until that happens. It was not in vain that Jesus asked in Luke 18 and 8, "Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth?" But the article did help me conclude that if this is where we go when we get away from the basic foundations of the Bible teaching, when we start speculating on the deeper things, it only takes you a mere 60 years to depart from the truth in such a manner, then it's fairly easy to refocus our attention on those same basic and shallow points of my last four lectures and of all the rest of the lectures and exhortations made from this platform over the last 130 years. For you see, the question we have assembled to consider this evening is not a new or novel question. It is really the same question which the disciples asked Jesus some 2,000 years ago. Just before he ascended into heaven for the final time after his resurrection, and after the disciples had walked with him for 40 days, they asked him one specific question. Can we imagine this? Can we put ourselves in the place of the disciples for a minute? You've walked with this man who you viewed as Israel's Messiah, Israel's future king, for 3.5 years. Here is the one so long promised. And you're familiar with those promises, such as the one made to David in 2 Samuel 7 at verse 12. And when thy days be fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels. And I will establish his kingdom. He shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the stripes of the children of men. But my mercy shall not depart away from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. And thine house and thy kingdom shall be established forever before thee. thy throne shall be established forever. This Messiah was promised to sit on David's throne forever. And as the children of Israel walked with him, they knew that this was going to be the case. The prophet spoke of it. Our modern world sings of it. In Isaiah chapter 9 at verse 6, we read, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it, with judgment and with justice, from henceforth, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this." Now, knowing these things, you have forsook home and jobs and family to walk with this man. You have done so for the past 3.5 years. And recently you saw him enter into Jerusalem, and the people threw palms in this way, praising him as the Messiah as he entered the city. And Jesus himself had recently referred to himself as the Messiah, the King of Jerusalem, to the people at that time. You watched as he looked down on the city of Jerusalem before him and proclaimed concerning his triumphant return in Matthew 23. "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou which killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her children under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." Surely that day when Jesus would say, "Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord," could not be far off now. The conflict with the ruling class around was becoming too great and too intense. This can't go on much longer this way. But then your worst fears were realized. The religious and political powers of the day took him and mocked him and crucified him. Your hopes of him establishing the kingdom are dashed. Your very faith is challenged. But then you witness a stunning miracle. Mary and Peter and John are testifying that he is resurrected to life. Thomas is confronted by Jesus and he puts his hands in the marks which resulted from his crucifixion. This is Jesus resurrected to life. And now for 40 days, a month and 10 days, he instructs you concerning all his teachings of those past 3.5 years. He explains those hard sayings and what he meant, how Messiah had to suffer and die and be resurrected to life. Now, if we had been in that position, do you think we would have been paying attention? Would all of us not have been hanging on his every word? And in that condition, what was the last question that the disciples asked him after those 40 days? In Acts chapter 1 at verse 6 we read, "When they therefore were come together, they asked of him, saying, Lord, wilt thou at this time restore again the kingdom unto Israel?" That is the question we have assembled here this evening to consider. Are we nearing the time when Christ shall again restore the kingdom to Israel? Now, God has not left us without a witness that this is the case. He has not left us without proof that he is still going to work out his plan of salvation in the earth. He left us, the people of Israel, as a witness that he is continuing to work out his plan. God issued this challenge to the nations of the earth, through the prophet Isaiah concerning Israel. In Isaiah 43 at verse 9, God said, "Let all the nations be gathered together, and let all the people be assembled. Who among them can declare this and show us the former things? Let them bring forth their witnesses, that they may be justified, or let them hear and say it is truth." This was God's challenge. "Bring forth your prophecies," God says to the nations. "Declare the former things. Tell us the things which are going to come to pass. Prophesy, and let that prophesy come to pass, that we may know that your God speak the truth. And God went on to say that he would answer this challenge, that all the earth would understand that God rules now as always in the kingdoms of men. And he would do so through his nation Israel. To Israel God said in Isaiah 43 at verse 10, "Ye are my witnesses, saith the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen, that ye may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God formed, neither shall there be after me. I, even I, am the Lord, and besides me there is no Savior. I have declared and have saved and have showed when there was no strange God among you. Therefore ye are my witnesses, saith the Lord, that I am God." This was the challenge God made. And it was not going to be a good challenge for Israel. Israel had been subjected to kings, some good, but mostly wicked, for about 400 years when God made this challenge. And throughout that time, Israel had been mostly a disobedient nation. From the earliest time when Israel had been formed into the nation and from the giving of the Mosaic Law, God had promised Israel that if they were obedient to divine precept, God would be merciful to them and make them plentiful in the earth. But if they were disobedient, then they would be subject to destruction by their enemies. So God, speaking to them through the prophet at a time when they were particularly wicked, and promising to use them as a witness to his workings, necessarily meant that Israel was in for some very bad times. And we know from history that they were. In the Mosaic Law, God promised Israel in regards to their disobedience in Leviticus 26:18, "And if you will not yet for all this hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins." This promise of seven times of punishments is made four times in this chapter. Israel was to be punished seven times for their sins. Well, what's a time? We see this expression all through the prophecies of the scriptures. A time was considered to be a full circle of the earth around the sun, which the Jews had divided into 12 months of 30 days, totaling 360 days. This is actually where the 360 degrees of our modern circle comes from, that we all learned in our math classes in school. So a time is a period of 360 days. In the Mosaic Law, as we have seen, God told Israel that they would be punished seven times for their sins. On the principle of a day for a year, seven times 360 comes out to 2,520 years. So the question for us is, does this match any historic time that the prophecy of God might be seen to be true? Well, the nation that history tells us conquered Jerusalem to begin the seven times of punishment was the great nation of Babylon, the first worldwide empire. And Babylon, according to modern archaeologists, conquered Jerusalem for the first time in the winter of 604 BC. If we were to read the Encyclopedia Britannica about this event, we would see that they used the date 604 BC. And this is the date used by almost all modern authorities, including the biblical archaeology and archaeology today. This date has been changed many times over the last 30 years, but it's now pretty well settled since the last 10 by archaeologists that this is the correct time. Well, if we add seven times, or 2,520 years, to 604 BC, what do we get? Well, a negative 604 plus 2520 is 1918. In archaeological times, that is, whenever the letters AD or BC are used, there is no year zero. So it doesn't quite work like mathematics. We must subtract a year every time we go from BC to AD, or vice versa. When we do so, we come to the winter of 1917, the exact time when in World War I when Israel was removed from the Turkish power and from all the powers of hostile foreign interests for the first time in their history in 2,520 years. It was in November 1917 when Britain, under the leadership of Field Marshal Allenby, defeated the Turks in Gaza. And on December 9th, 1917, Allenby marched into Jerusalem, freeing the city from the control of the Turks. The Encyclopedia Britannica records this of Allenby: Allenby's service in the Middle East proved more distinguished. In June 1917, he took command of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force. The strength of his personality created a new spirit in his army, and after careful preparation and reorganization, he won a decisive victory over the Turks at Gaza, November 1917, which led to the capture of Jerusalem, December 9, 1917. Further advances were checked by calls from France for his troops, but after receiving reinforcements, he won a decisive victory at Megiddo on September 19, 1918, which followed his capture of Damascus and Aleppo, ended Ottoman power in Syria. So in 1917, the seven times of punishments had been completed on Israel, and for the first time in 2,520 years, Israel was no longer controlled by a hostile northern power. Because of this long period of punishment that the Jews have endured, many Christians reached the conclusion that God had cast Israel off forever. But God said that was not his plan. Yes, Israel was to be punished for their disobedience, but then they are to be regathered into Israel. Jeremiah 32 at verse 36 we read, "And now therefore thus saith the Lord, the God of Israel, concerning this city whereof ye say, it shall be delivered into the hand of the king of Babylon by the sword and by the famine and by the pestilence. Behold, I will gather them out of all countries whither I have driven them in mine anger and in my fury and in great wrath. And I will bring them again unto this place, and I will cause them to dwell safely, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God." Because if Israel was never to be regathered, then the promises which God made to David, which we have already seen, could not be fulfilled. And these prophecies, such as we just read in Jeremiah, could never be fulfilled. But God asks us in this regard concerning the rebirth of Israel, in Isaiah 66 at verse 8, "Who hath heard such a thing? Who hath seen such things? Shall the earth be made to bring forth in one day? Or shall a nation be born at once? For as soon as Zion travailed, she brought forth her children. Shall I bring to the birth and not cause to bring forth, saith the Lord? Shall I cause to bring forth and shut the womb, saith thy God?" Israel was to be brought forth by God, and he had the power to do it. And they did come forth in a day. In one day she was made a nation by the United Nations, but they were simply doing that which had been preordained from the prophets of old. As we saw in the chapter we opened with this evening, Ezekiel 37, God determined that Israel should rise from this heap of dried bones which the prophets saw, which they were before the British invasions into the Palestine, and that they would to ultimately stand up a mighty nation. So let's look briefly at the development of Israel. The first Zionist conference was held in 1898. The stated goal of that conference was to get a homeland for Israel. At this conference, they were not really concerned where that home would be. In fact, many wanted the home to be in Liberia, in Africa. But they just wanted some home. In 1917, the British government, through the Balfour Declaration, pledged support to the Zionist goal of a homeland for Israel. In 1922, Britain, through the League of Nations, which was the forerunner to the United Nations, was given an official mandate over Palestine, which of course eventually was renamed Israel. Now, while all this was going on, there was very little immigration to Israel. No one wanted to leave the comforts of Europe and go to this sparse and poorly populated desert. There was important work going on there, such as the rebirth of the Hebrew language, which had died, which was being done by Ben Yehuda. But for various reasons, which are political and religious and economic, the Jews did not readily leave the comforts of life in Europe and the United States and other parts of the world to return to Israel. But then came the 1930s and the outbreak of anti-Semitism in Europe. This fierce persecution increased the number of Jews immigrating to Israel. But in doing so, it upset the Arabs who were already there in Palestine and living under the British mandate. The British then limited immigration of Jews to only 176,000 per year. But by the end of World War II, the Jews had been forced to realize the importance of establishing a Jewish state, that such genocide which happened against them at that time would not happen again. The United Nations, through the support of the United States and surprisingly Russia, it issued its mandate in November of 1947, declaring Israel a sovereign state. The British abandoned their mandate on May 13, 1948, and Israel, in one day, stood up a nation on May 14, 1948. At the time Israel declared her independence, there was an estimated 650,000 Jews in Israel. By 1952, that number had doubled. She fought a war in 1948 against the Arabs, and in spite of overwhelming odds, she was victorious. In 1956, she again fought a war, this time against Egypt, heavily backed by the former Soviet Union, and again was victorious. After both the 1948 and 1956 wars, Israel returned to her boundaries as established by the United Nations. But after 1956, Israel entered a period of unprecedented economic growth, and with that again spurred immigration, taking the number of Israelis living in Palestine or in Israel to over 3 million. In 1967, Israel fought another war called the Six-Day War. And following that war, Israel refused to give up the territory she had won until peace treaties were signed by her Arab neighbors. In 1973, during Yom Kippur on the Jewish New Year, the Jews were again attacked by the Arabs, but again had no trouble fending them off. In 1977, Jerusalem was made the capital city of Israel, to the chagrin of all the nations. The capital had formerly been Tel Aviv. And this was thought to be a major stumbling block to lasting peace, because Jerusalem had been a divided city by the United Nations mandate. The Jews had taken all of Jerusalem in 1967 and now were refusing to give it back. They still haven't given it back. It's notable that the loudest voice in this country, in the United States, against establishing Jerusalem as a capital city for Israel came from the American Council of Churches. Christianity still not understanding the role that Israel was going to play in God's plan. They simply cannot see the hand of God at work and bringing Israel back into existence. So we can see this happened exactly as the prophet declared. Dry bone came to dry bone. Events seemingly irrelevant became the substance of international debate until Israel was again established as a nation. And when she stood up on that fateful day in May in 1948, she stood up a nation powerful enough to take on 14 other nations at once when she was outnumbered 90-1, and she defeated her enemy. Though she did not know at that time that it was God who fought for her, and she still doesn't know. But it is not enough that Israel was to be developed to bring about the events of the time of the end, when Jesus will return to restore his kingdom to Israel. Other nations in the world had to come in the line. If we are truly living in the time of the end, we should see the rest of the world lining up in their proper prophetic roles as well. In Ezekiel 38, at verses 1 through 6, we read about the northern invader into Israel, the opponent to Israel who will try and conquer her. We read there, "And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back, and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth, and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. Persia, which is Iran, Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer and all his bands, and the house of Togarmah, and the north quarters with all its bands, and many people with thee. These are the nations that are to be Israel's enemies at the time of Christ's return. At first, they appear to be a bunch of funny-sounding names, but they are simply the names of the ancient nations in antiquity. The chief prince of Meshech and Tubal might better be translated, as it is in the Revised Version, Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. These are the ancient names of three river regions of Russia. Rosh is Russia proper, Meshech is the Moscow region, the Muscovy, and Tubal is the Tobolsky regions of northern Russia. Magog and Gomer are the names of the peoples who first populated continental Europe. The historian Herodotus tells us that the people Magog settled north of the Danube River and became the Germanic peoples, while the peoples of Gomer settled south of the Danube and became the Romanic tribes of southern Europe, of France and Belgium. So the confederation against Israel at the time of the end is to be Russia, leading all the nations of continental Europe, and she leads them against Israel. Is Russia hostile to Israel today? Remember the recent war where Russia invaded a fellow member of the former Soviet Union, which was Georgia? Russia placed the blame for the persecution of Russian citizens in Georgia squarely at the feet of Israel. In a Times magazine following the war, they recorded this, August 21, 2008. Time magazine writes, "But if the Israelis were looking to downplay the significance of military ties, that is between Israel and Georgia, they weren't helped by comments like Yakubashvili's or by Georgia President Mikhail Saakashvili's enthusing at a press conference earlier this week that the Israeli weapons have been very effective. It is very effective against Russia. Nor did the Russians fail to notice. Israel armed the Georgian army," grumbled General Anatoly Nogovitsyn, deputy chief of staff of the Russian military, at a press conference in Moscow earlier this week. An Israeli paper had last weekend quoted an unnamed official warning that Israel needed to be very careful and sensitive these days. The Russians are selling many arms to Iran and Syria, and there is no need to offer them an excuse to sell even more advanced weapons. As if on cue, on Wednesday, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad arrived in Moscow hoping to persuade Russia to sell him sophisticated air defense systems, and reportedly offering the Russian Navy the use of one of its Mediterranean ports. Late on Wednesday, the Israeli foreign minister announced that Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev had spoken on the phone to clear the air over the Georgia conflict and the Russian arms sales to Syria. The Times article points out that right on cue, the Syrians and the Iranians asked for and received, by the way, a more sophisticated missile defense system. And also right on cue, Russia began dredging the Syrian port of Tartus in preparation to receive the newer and larger Russian warships. That project is now nearly finished. As the United Press International reported a few weeks ago, on July 21st in UPI, the Russian Navy is reported to be moving ahead with plans to upgrade its Soviet-era naval base at the Syrian port of Tartus in the eastern Mediterranean. Rio Novosti Monday quoted a senior Russian Navy source as saying that following the modernization, the naval maintenance site at Tartus will become fully operational. So Russia is clearly arming herself and taking up a position beside her loyal allies of Syria and Iran in the Middle East. And I think everyone is aware that the greatest threat to Israel at the present moment is the development of the nuclear weapons by Iran. Iran is the Persia listed with the northern invaders of Israel, which we just looked at in Ezekiel 38. It is Russia who is selling them the power plant, the nuclear power plant itself, along with the nuclear material for the plant and the technical support, and also blocking the attempts of the United States to end Iran's nuclear program. United States President Barack Obama went to Russia this past month to seek Russian cooperation in stopping Iran from developing nuclear weapons. News.com reported this as the outcome of those meetings in its English edition. From July 12, 2009, Cohen is a Brookings Institute Russian expert who went with President Obama, says the Russians are key in preventing Iran from having a nuclear weapons program. Unless they are actively engaged and are willing to commit to that, then I don't see a peaceful resolution on that issue. And I think most people look at that whole situation in the Middle East as being very volatile and don't want to see military action taken. But frankly, we've already seen discussions about Israel, and I know that Israel is concerned about Iran, as are other countries in the region. Very concerned about Iran possessing a nuclear weapon. Diplomacy is key, and Russia is going to be key to achieving that diplomacy, he said. The Newscom article went on quoting another U.S. senior state official named David Kramer. However, David Kramer says Russia's influence over Iran is limited. I am not optimistic that we will get Russia on board in dealing with Iran. Russia really is not interested in applying pressure to the regime in Tehran. They'd rather have the United States and other countries do that. Russia has other interests in Iran. It has a different perception of the threat, though there were some indications coming out of the summit that there was a narrowing of those different perceptions. I'll believe it when I see it, he said. So Russia's position in the earth today is exactly what the scripture says it is to be, one of hostility toward Israel and a friend of Israel's enemies. In the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, where we read of this northern invader, the northern power has an antagonist. The northern power is meant by a southern power described as the merchants of Tarshish with all her young lions. In Ezekiel 38 and 13, we read this: Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish with all the young lions thereof shall say unto thee, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered a company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, and to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? Now, Tarshish in history appears to be somewhat of a symbolical name given both to great naval powers and to great naval vessels of the world, and also given to the wealthiest nations of the world by reason of their great trading powers over the sea. Tarshish is a loyal friend and protectorate to Israel in the scriptures. Isaiah says that she spreads her wings over Israel. Tyre was the queen city of Tarshish, and from the earliest days, Hiram and his son Hiram II, kings of Tyre, were both close friends with David and Solomon, and participated with Solomon in building the temple and providing the timber and the castings for the first temple. So there has always been a close relationship between Israel and Tarshish. In Isaiah 18 at verse 1, which is poorly translated in the King James, we read a verse about Tarshish overshadowing the Holy Land with wings. That verse should read, as it's translated by Dr. John Thomas, in Isaiah 18 and 1, Ho, land of widely overshadowing wings, extending from beyond the rivers of Cush, which sendeth by sea whirling things, even upon vessels of fleetness on the surface of waters. Go swiftly, ye fleet messengers, to a nation carried away and oppressed, to a people terrible from this and onward, a nation prostrate and trodden down, whose lands the rivers have spoiled. These fleet vessels upon the sea, which traveled by whirling things, was probably the prophet's best description of the propellers driving these modern vessels over to the downtrodden to protect Israel. The rivers of Cush in that verse are the rivers of northern Cush and not Ethiopia, as the King James has it, so that the land beyond the rivers of Cush is the land beyond the Tigris and Euphrates River of central and southern Iraq. That is, the land of northern Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. The land where today the British and American troops are embroiled in a terrible battle. And isn't it interesting how politics has driven the United States and Britain to fight an unpopular and dangerous war, ending up with large armies beyond the rivers of Cush, and bringing criticisms against the former Bush administration while running for president? Then candidate Obama claimed that President Bush was fighting the wrong war, Al-Qaeda was in Afghanistan, not Iraq, he claimed. He promised that if he won the presidency, he would fight the correct war. So now, having won the presidency, President Obama is embroiled in a very difficult war that he can't get free from. And now he has 66,000 American troops in Afghanistan and 50,000 troops in northeastern Iraq, or 111,000 total troops beyond the rivers of Kush, just where the prophets said they must be. Now we note that the prophet's words to Ezekiel was, "Art thou come to take a spoil?" It is not, "Are you going over to Israel to take a spoil?" but "Art thou come?" So Tarshish with their young lions are already in Israel at the time of the end. It's not hard to see that there is today in the earth a group of nations set for the defense of Israel, which of course is the British-American alliance. These nations maintain permanent fleets in the Mediterranean Sea and in the Indian Ocean surrounding Israel. And there also is currently a fleet in the Persian Gulf. These nations recently participated in bringing down Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which was set on the destruction of Israel. They both continue to fight in the region, both in Iraq and in Afghanistan, attempting to destroy the Arab extremists, which are a threat to Israel. So clearly, Tarshish is already in the land and already overshadowing with wings and their fleet vessels set for a defense against the growing Russian presence. Now, earlier we saw how Russia is in building up Iran. Iran or Persia is one of the countries of those Northern Alliance, as we have already said. So it is necessary that as we near Christ's return, we should see Russia and Iran in closer cooperation, just as we see today. And we have already referenced how strong this alliance is, so strong that President Obama was not able to get the cooperation he wanted from Russia earlier this month. But those talks between the United States and Russia has had another effect in making the friends of the United States quite nervous. Faced with the likelihood of a nuclear Iran, the United States has been trying to reassure Israel that they come under the umbrella of the United States Nuclear Defense Shield, and that they will be protected from Iran. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, when she was running for president, had said that if Iran attacked Israel, that the response would be massive. But of course, she lost the election, so it is no longer exactly clear what the American and British response would be. But earlier this year, there was a leak of information in February that the United States had offered to barter away the proposed European Missile Defense Plan, which Russia hates. And they were offering to barter this plan away if Russia would intervene against Iran and stop the nuclear weapon program. Now, the Nuclear Missile Defense Plan is a plan where the United States wants to put anti-missile missiles in Europe to knock down any missiles coming from Iran. But rather than accept the ending of the plan that they really dislike, Russia saw a greater advantage in making political hay by going public with the offer and unnerving Israel and also the European states, who too thought they were coming underneath the American military umbrella. By going public with the offer, Russia was able to embarrass the United States and make the European allies question just how loyal an ally the U.S. really is to them. The Russians opposed the European missile shield because they feel that ultimately, with technological advances, it will be able to be used against them, even if right now it would only be operational against rogue states like North Korea and Iran. The European states, especially those of the former Eastern Bloc, have been very much pro the United States in their policies since the breakup of the former Soviet Union. And they wanted the European Missile Defense Shield for the same reason Russia didn't want them to have it, for an ultimate defense against Russia. So European states, which have previously felt the oppression of the Russian army, want the missile shield for the same reasons the Russians don't want them to have it. Europe, from a scriptural standpoint, as we've seen this evening, must be with Russia at the time of the end. So a change must take place in this relationship between the United States and Europe. And it will be interesting to watch how this develops now that they have learned only 4 months ago that the ally that they have been leaning on, the United States, was willing to barter away their national security. But even Israel has been unnerved by the willingness of the United States to stop its missile defense program. Secretary Clinton was asked directly about this by Israel last March, to which she answered, "We have said specifically in regard to missile defense in Europe is that it has always been intended to deter any missile that might come from Iran," Clinton said. "It remains our position. We have explained that to the Russians before." That answer was viewed as evasive because it only focused on missiles from Iran. But the real threat to Europe and to Israel is Russia. And it didn't rule out bartering the program away in exchange for some cooperation with Russia and stopping Iran's nuke program. And Mrs. Clinton said nothing about that. The ultimate goal of the missile defense shield was supposed to be able to protect Israel and Europe from all missiles, not just Iran. And so it will be interesting to watch where this all goes in the future. Also affecting Europe and its relation to Israel is the new Pope, Pope Benedict XVI. When Pope John Paul II died, many thought that since so much of Catholicism's recent converts had come from the New World, that the next Pope would also come from the New World to Catholicism, perhaps from Africa or from South America. Especially was this the case as Catholicism had fallen on hard times in Europe. But this wasn't to be the case. The new Pope was from the heart of Europe, from Germany, and he took the name Benedict to show his intentions. The first Pope Benedict is regarded as the Pope which was responsible for turning Europe to Catholicism in the first place. Taking his name showed that the intent of this Pope was to revive Catholicism in Europe. And of course, Catholicism and the Jews are enemies with a 2,000-year history. Even the Protestant movement itself is rooted in the hostility between Catholicism and Judaism. As men began to read their Bibles again, and as they read Revelation 17 and the discussion of the immoral woman who opposes Christ, they began to claim that this was in fact the religion to which they belonged. They believed the woman in Revelation 17, the immoral woman, was Catholicism described symbolically. And they left the Roman Church to form the various Protestant denominations. And so in their defense, the Catholic clergy said that the chapter is not about Rome, but about Jerusalem. The Antichrist will come from Jerusalem, they claim. The Antichrist is not Catholicism, but Judaism. And so it is not surprising today to see the Pope call for a Palestinian state on Israeli soil. The following is from the Times Online from last May. It gives us a good picture of Pope Benedict's recent work. We read there, "The Pope gave his most forthright endorsement of a Palestinian state yesterday as his Holy Land pilgrimage took him to a refugee camp in the shadow of Israel's controversial separation barrier. The Holy See supports the right of your people to be sovereign Palestinian homeland in the land of your forefathers, secure and at peace with your neighbors within internationally recognized borders," Benedict XVI told Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president. The German pontiff, who had incurred Israel's anger for not appearing to show enough remorse during a visit to the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem, was greeted with exuberant warmth in Ada, a shabby suburb of Bethlehem, that started life as a camp for Palestinian refugees from the 1948 war with Israel. A home for Palestinians in the land of their forefathers would of course mean the ending of the nation of Israel, something God has brought back from the valley of dry bones and something which will remain until Christ's return. So the work of the Pope in bringing Catholicism back to Europe and his call for a Palestinian state will work with the distrust the U.S. government has given Europe over the missile shield and to make them ripe pickings for Russia when she is ready to come down upon the mountains of Israel. Now, besides the European states, which we have discussed, there are also Arab states which have to be correctly aligned at Christ's return. The first of these major states was Egypt. Egypt was Israel's enemy in all the Arab wars, and even led two of the wars. But the Bible said that Egypt, the typical king of the south, was to be with Israel at the time of the end. And so in 1979, when the first peace treaty between the Jews and Arabs was signed, this was a treaty between Israel and Egypt. This resulted in Israel returning occupied territories to the Egyptians. The peace treaty was thought to be impossible on several counts. First and foremost, Abdel Nasser, a former Egyptian prime minister, had thrown Egypt into the political orb of the Soviet Union. Khrushchev, the Soviet's president, had one word for those who had made such a treaty with Russia, and that word was irreversible. But Egypt did reverse, and Anwar Sadat in the late 70s threw the Russians out of Egypt. Secondly, the peace treaty was thought to be impossible because Israel's taking of the entire city of Jerusalem was thought to have made peace between the Arabs and Jews impossible. Nevertheless, the treaty was signed in 1979 by Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. And in that same year, Anwar Sadat spoke at the Knesset in Jerusalem. But other Arab states had to be added. All the states of the southern Arabian Peninsula, along with Jordan, needed to ally themselves with Israel. How unlikely did this seem only 20 years ago? Did you know that 20 years ago, if an American automobile maker wished to market his product in Saudi Arabia, he had to first give assurances that he would not do so in Israel? And not just automobiles, but virtually all products were under such scrutiny by the Arab world, which had such a hatred for Israel. Then in 1991, Saddam Hussein, president of Iraq, which must be allied against Israel at the time of the end, launched a war on neighboring Kuwait and set eyes on Saudi Arabia. Iraq had the strongest Arab army in the region, and the southern Arab power needed support from the West to fend off the Iraqis. They enlisted the help of the United States to do so in an event we all know as the Gulf War I. The Americans agreed to help because they needed to stop Iraqi aggression to maintain the free flow of oil at market prices, as badly as the Saudis needed their help. But as a condition of assistance, the Arabs were forced to agree to drop all economic sanction on American companies doing business in Israel. This they agreed to, and that has led to a peace accord between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which continues to this day. Also during the Gulf War, Jordan also said by the scriptures to be an ally of Israel at the time of the end, picked the wrong side in that war. Jordan, you will recall, backed the Iraqis completely. They violated the sanctions continuously. They refused to help the Saudis in any way. When Gulf War I was over, Jordan found themselves in an awful mess. While the war had not taken place at all in Jordan, Jordan found herself cut off from the world because of the new sanctions against her for backing the Iraqis. Now, how was Jordan ever to pull herself back into the good graces of the world's community? The method she found was by signing her own peace treaty with Israel. So now the stage is set in the Middle East among the southern nations for the return of Christ. And with the collapse of the Iraqi government at the end of Gulf War II, Iran has emerged as the great power of the region, frightening the southern Arab nations. Saudi Arabia has come to fear Iran with her Russian allies more than they dislike Israel. And so they have entered into pacts of mutual defense against Iran. So the complete alliance in the south is now in place. It's in place today, ready for the return of Christ. And so it is with great expectation we ask again, Lord, wilt thou at this time restore the kingdom unto Israel? Concerning Israel, God said in Deuteronomy 32 at verse 8, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in a waste howling wilderness. He led him about. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. Israel is the apple of God's eye. They are his chosen people. Not because of the wicked men who have brought God's punishment upon Israel, but because of the righteous men to whom God made the many promises of the scriptures. By watching the nation of Israel, we can see that God is now and ever has been working out his plan of salvation for mankind. May it be our lot that we might be able to stand in that land in the last days, witnessing the end of that great prophecy of the 37th and 39th chapters of Ezekiel. We read in Ezekiel 39 at verse 27, "When I have brought them again from the people and gathered them out of their enemies' land and sanctified in them in the sight of many nations, then shall they know that I am the Lord their God, which caused them to be led into captivity among the heathen. But I have gathered them into their own land and have left none of them any more there. Neither will I hide my face any more from them, for I have poured out my spirit upon the house of Israel, saith the Lord God." Now all of these events that we have been discussing this morning are a cause of great consternation among the nations. But they are a source of hope and comfort for us. For they are a testimony of the approaching time when God will send Jesus to the earth to bring the nations together and to be subjected to him and to the saints. May we, all of us here, be among those with our lamps trimmed and well burning, and not among those who ask, "Where is the promise of his coming?"